From awaytogarden.com and robinhoodradio.com, this is A Way to Garden with Margaret Roach, your weekly invitation to dig in and grow.
Gardeners, including myself, want to add more native plants to their landscapes to support pollinators and birds and other native wildlife. But if our beds and borders are already established, do we have to erase them and start over? Making room for habitat-style planting, even in an established garden, is today's topic, with my friend Ken Drews here to help. But first, this message.
Underwriting support from Timber Press, your go-to resource for books in gardening and nature. Whether you're a new gardener, a professional at the top of your field, or a reader interested in the wonders of the natural world, their books are there to help you grow. TimberPress.com.
As promised, my friend Ken Drews is here to help, talking about making room for more native plants, even in our established gardens. How are you over there in your established garden, Ken?
Oh, excuse me. I've got a shoehorn here, trying to get a few native plants in.
I know. Oh, my goodness.
I'm pretty good, Margaret.
Before we get started on this sort of, on the making room for more native subject, actually, an urgent garden question arrived the other day from a listener reader related to native plants about pruning southern magnolias. And I wanted to just throw it out to you because I think you've probably grown Magnolia virginiana, and in my colder, windier site, they probably are evergreen. They wouldn't be so good. So I just wanted to read you Bonnie's question and see if I could get your two cents.
Oh, I have a question for you. Now, do you mean grandiflora?
I'm sorry. Yes.
Well, it's both of those are interesting.
Edith Bogue.
Right. Grandiflora.
Sorry.
Magnolia grandiflora.
Yeah. So Edith Bogue, she says, Bonnie is the reader, and she says, I want to know if you should prune an Edith Bogue magnolia. Mine's about 8 to 9 years old, she says. It's getting rather bushy and is more of a bush than a tree. She wants to know what she can do about that. So,
well, it's a kind of a bushy plant naturally.
It is.
I grow a few by the road as a screen, and they're fantastic, and they're totally evergreen in my zone 6A garden. But they're shrubby.
Yeah.
They grow more like Christmas trees than lollipops. And
right.
I just make mine a little bit tidier every year, just prune them a bit. But one could prune it into a lollipop or enjoy it as a fat plant that you can't see the road through.
I think, though, at 8 to 9 years, I mean, it wants to be pyramidal. Is that the word? Pyramidal? I never know how to pronounce that.
Sure.
The accent should be on which syllable, right? Is that the question? So you know, it's bushier at the bottom and then narrower at the top. I mean, that's
it
natural habitat.
Doesn't lose its bottom branches, which is great.
Right. So if it were a young plant in the field at the wholesale nursery when it was a baby and it was getting trained, that would to me be the time maybe more to shape it a little bit. Do you know what I mean? That not 8 or 9 years after she's had it, which means it's probably 15 years or whatever, ever, you know, 12, 13 years after it got its early training, whatever that was. So
once they get going, they're pretty fast. I think
yeah.
8 or 9, that's probably a pretty big plant.
That's what I mean, yeah. Is that, yeah. So yes, you can. I would never cut partway into a branch of one of these, would you? I mean, I would take out a branch.
No, I think you could shape it.
Actually. Oh, you could?
Yeah.
Huh. Yeah, I think of them as, again, they have such a distinctive shape, form.
Well, Edith Bogue is kind of chubby, and they also depending on the light, because in the shade they're gangly kind of, but
uh-huh.
They'll do okay. And as you said, in the field when it's trimmed, it probably is a Christmas tree shape, pretty much, or something like that.
Right.
But in a garden and with a little shade, and depending on the moisture and everything, it could be. Mine gets kind of out of shape, and I do just prune back. I'll prune back halfway on a branch if it's sticking out in the wrong direction and it looks like it's misshapen.
Oh, so you'll go back part of the way into one
mm-hmm.
of them. Okay.
Mm-hmm.
Okay. All right. Good. So the reason I bring that question in, even though we're going to kind of digress slightly, is that magnolia, as I've been corrected, grandiflora, which is what I meant to say, not virginiana, another native magnolia mm-hmm. species, right? You know, those are native, but they're not native where you garden or where I garden. And so, you know, we want to add more natives to our landscapes and so forth. And, you know, when you and I began gardening, most of the sort of it plants, and really I think it's still true in many cases, were Asian plants, plants of Asian origin, yes?
Mostly. Well, they were aliens.
Yeah.
Or exotics, because some came from Europe too, but I'd say that was sort of the trendy thing.
Yeah.
Was for Asian plants because, for example, Japan and a lot of China has a very similar climate to ours.
To the eastern
U.S.,
yes.
Plants from Japan have been around since like the 1850s or 60s, but China, it was all new.
Yeah. So you and I both began, we got the bug, and we began as sort of collectors of cool things from oddball catalogs before the internet, not that we're old or anything. and in fact, you even did a book called The Collector's Garden in 1996, but 2 years before that, you already had an inkling about natives sort of before its time has come in a big way, and you wrote a book called The Natural Habitat Garden in 1994. And so and you were kind enough to sort of take me to all these incredible places where people who, again, were ahead of the curve were gardening with natives. But here we are. We still kept collecting things. And what are we doing, sort of? What's the remedy, you know? If we want to be more ecological, environmental, et cetera. I mean, I'm not throwing out my whole garden. That's the punchline for me. But I'm trying to come up with ways to make room. And I think you are too, yes?
And encourage people to think about this in the future. I think that if I could have an all-native garden, I would. But I can't. Mm-hmm. And it's not just because of the wonderful plants I've planted over the years, although it has a lot to do with that. But, well, there's some of them are so wonderful. So like you said, I'm not going to plow them all under. Some of them are gigantic trees. But I'm, you know, one thing I did is I took a survey of the plants that are here that are actually indigenous to my county in the northwest corner of New Jersey.
Wow.
And I found that there were over 100 species.
In your garden.
And they're planted like, you know, there's a phlox in with the other plants and there's so many. And you probably remember I have a woodland garden that I made from the start 20 years ago with mostly plants from a 10-mile radius of this site or where I live. But it's a very complex site because it's an island and a river and a hardwood forest, so there's a lot to choose from. But there is a lot to choose from, and there are many, many places online, you were talking about online, where you can find lists of the plants that are indigenous or native to your area.
Right. And with a transcript of the show, I can give at least a starter list of some of those. I felt really lucky, I don't know how many years ago, within the last 5 or so years, there's a kind of an ecology project, a nonprofit near me that actually for years has been doing, I'm in Columbia County, New York, and they've been doing the flora of, you know, the plant diversity of Columbia County, and they've been surveying and, you know, keeping records and so forth. And so now where did you find yours? How did you do that? You just did a search for your county?
I had Native Plants of New Jersey.
Okay.
And then I went to the native plant, you know, New Jersey natives, and it's a wildflower. It's not wildflower. It's native plant site. And then it had areas, and then it had counties. And I clicked on my county, and up came this Excel sheet with hundreds of plants, and it was great. So I just looked at the ones on the list that I already am growing, and then I checked some of them against the USDA map just to check, another good site to check out. And I was surprised. And I'm not talking about nativars. Is that what they're called?
Ah, yes, cultivars of native plants. That was one of the big heartbreaks for me as I've learned more over the years, because when you and I remember distinctly, when you and I, you know, I worked with you on the Natural Habitat Garden in the early 90s, and we went to visit places, and I remember going to Mount Cuba Center, which mm-hmm. I think then was called like Mount Cuba Center for the Study of the Piedmont Plants. It's in
Flora.
Piedmont flora. Thank you. And it's in Delaware. Yes. Mm-hmm. And we went to see the great plant person, Dick Leidy, who was directing it then. And he was showing us cultivars or better forms of native plants that they were working on, and then introducing like a white trillium that reproduced more easily, so that it could, you know, you could have more of them and they weren't $1 million, because in those days trilliums were barely in the market, right? Unless they had been stolen from the wild,
right?
So he was showing us his various, you know, developments, and I can remember all the way back to then. And of course, I adopted some of the plants that I learned about that day, and subsequently from his work and others like him. And some had variegated leaves or had purple leaves or whatever, not the plain green. And I was devastated over recent years to learn that, you know, some of those aren't as attractive to the native insects or whatever who have evolved alongside them. They're not tasty. They're not nutritious to them. They aren't a good host plant or whatever.
They also might be more vigorous than the actual natives.
Yeah.
And push out the actual natives. And as you always used to say, only one plant can live in one place at one time.
Did I used to say that? Uh-huh. Yeah. I mean, double flowers, for instance. And that's another one. You know, because they don't have the nutritious value, you know, to these insects as the same as the single flowers that nature might have made. So it looks prettier in the garden maybe, but...
And it might attract insects too, but they don't get a reward. They don't get...
Correct.
There's no... Well, like a double rose, there isn't any pollen.
Right. So the nectar and the pollen resources would be diminished or absent or whatever. So, right. So, you know, these were hard. These have been the harder, more recent lessons for me. So I guess the best thing that I did, and I don't really even know why I did it. I don't remember where I first met this plant, and I don't know if you grow it, but winterberry hollies. Do you grow winterberry hollies?
I do, but they look terrible because I'm not acidic enough.
Oh, interesting. Maybe it's because a nursery, a woody plant nursery near me has along the road, it's a rural place and it's a big property, and along the road they have, for the cut flower, you know, for the winter time, they sell Christmas trees, and then they have a lot of winterberries. Maybe because I always drove by them and I saw them at that time of year and they were so fabulous. I don't know. Maybe that's why I ended up with them, but right in the very beginning. But I don't remember, you know, they don't look showy. When you go to the garden center in spring, winterberry holly doesn't look like the sexiest thing in the store. Do you know what I mean? It's
sure.
It's a bunch of twigs. but I ended up planting maybe 40 or 50 of them around the place. And so now, thankfully, you know, I think I'm known to the birds of the area after 30-something years. You know, it's like I'm a favorite pit stop or something. And so those are real workhorse plants. Those do a really good job of feeding a lot of native animals, you know, especially birds. And the pollinators like them when they're flowering in the spring. So that was one thing I did right. But then one thing I did, and I'm going to put it in quotes, okay, wrong, was that, of course, I loved the variegated leaf or the purple leaf or the you know, I liked that cultivar, nativar form.
The golden berries.
Yeah. So, all right. So we've been thinking about this for a long time, but what are we going to do now? Like, how are we making room? Like, what are some of your tactics and so forth?
Well, you know, I was talking about that woodland bed that isn't very big, but if you have a spot on your property, you can make a little gilt garden. How about that? We'll call it a gilt garden, where you have a bed and you try to find out what the plants are that would fit that site and are not only indigenous or certainly not just native to the U.S., but local plants.
Right.
And then try to acquire them responsibly. Go to a native plant sale from a local native botanical garden or something like that. Almost all of them have annual sales.
Yes.
Or take a trip. Sounds good.
Yes.
And then you can make a bed that's specifically that and add native plants in with your other plantings. I grow so much Phlox paniculata and they're, Some of them are species because they revert to species form. But, you know, if you're growing, you can grow Phlox paniculata as part of your flower border. And that may be native. That's native for me.
Right. The tall phlox, the summertime, right, July kind right, of August.
Garden yeah. Phlox,
garden
right.
phlox. Uh-huh.
And they're wonderfully fragrant, too.
Now, Mount Cuba, a couple of years ago that we were talking about, Mount Cuba Center, they do have a trials garden about native plants, and they trial alongside one another, you know, hundreds of varieties. I mean, it depends on how many there are, but in the case of phlox, a lot of different varieties of phlox. And they, I'll give a link in the transcript of this show. They published a great report. It's available online, and it tells you which ones are the most insect-friendly of all the garden phlox, you know. And it's amazing, you know, by making the flowers bigger, which, again, breeders did, selecting for the larger flowers for garden appeal, didn't necessarily make them better. And, in fact, the one that's J-E-A-N-A, and I think you pronounce it Gina, but I don't know, phlox Gina, J-E-A-N-A, has the smallest flowers. They're purplish, pale purple, lavendery colored. And it's the most attractive by far to insects, to pollinators, and the most, you know, effective for them getting fed. So it's interesting. It's sort of counterintuitive, you know, small is sometimes better.
I just ordered that plant from Select Seeds.
Oh, you did? Oh, mm-hmm. Good. Well, you did a good thing. So you're...
Let's make a list of some things to do. If we can.
Yeah.
So never bring in a potentially invasive plant.
Right.
And that can even be a native plant. There's an anemone canadense here that is one of the worst weeds I've ever had, but it's a local plant and it's actually threatened in Massachusetts. Plant oaks, local oaks, mm-hmm. and you can tell why in a second. And if you've got some good plants on your property, leave them.
Yeah.
Encourage them. So how's that for a short list?
That's a short list. But and in terms of invasiveness, you said, you know, don't bring in any invasive plants, and we're going to try to eliminate some of the ones. I mean, I'm on a lifetime war against Oriental bittersweet, for instance.
But you didn't plant that.
I didn't, but the birds plant it every year again and again and again and again because it's everywhere around me in the edges of the woods and so forth. But, you know, people maybe don't know what are the invasives around them.
There's plenty of lists of that.
And it's great if you're thinking of buying a plant also. It's so great now, and this is what the internet is good for, you know, to do – if you just put in the word invasive and the name of the plant that you're thinking of ordering, you will almost immediately get the result with state by state what states' departments of natural resources have declared that plant invasive. And, I mean, this was a big aha for me, I don't know how many years ago, in the last 10 years, about double file viburnum, which was the most popular viburnum when we were all – starting to buy viburnums umpteen years ago. You know, it was the one, the gateway viburnum. and now what's the case? It's seeded into the woodlands just like that Oriental bittersweet. It's invading the woodlands in many areas. So you'll see it on, if you do a, you know, double file viburnum invasive, if you search for those three words on Google, you'll see what states have declared it an invasive. So it's actually quite easy to check yourself before you make an investment, especially in a plant that sets a lot of seed or fruit, you know.
Before you buy those barberries.
Oh, yeah. I think the other thing to do is that we can add to the to-do list is look for spaces, like look with a slightly more sort of stern eye. Look around your place for spaces. Like you talked about creating the gilt garden bed. And I've said this before on the program, but I'll say it again because it's been a real lesson for me. I was mowing up to the fence line all the way around my place. It's 2.3 acres, and I have a lot of giant beds, so it's not all lawn by any means. But even though I have kind of a meadow in one area up the hill, I was mowing up to the fence line behind that meadow and to the sides of that meadow and so forth. And I found that if I came in even, say, 6 or 8 feet, you know, stopped mowing around that 2.3-acre perimeter, came in 6 or 8 more feet, there was an opportunity for more plants than I can afford. Do you know what I mean? I could have a whole giant number of native viburnums and so forth, you know, lining that. You know, you can create these sort of edge beds, right? These sort of borrowed edge areas might be up against a fence or the neighbor's property or against a hedge, you know, where you can steal back some feet that right now you're just mowing it. And you could create a place for the winterberry hollies or the, you know, the native shrubs and a simple native ground cover.
And that can end up being less work.
Totally, totally. Yeah.
And as I get older, one thing I'm doing here is planting deciduous shrubs, native deciduous shrubs,
yes,
along those very edges.
Yes.
Because it just, and you know, some of them you don't ever touch.
Right. Right.
Plant them and forget them.
Right. And then obviously islands, I said on mowing, you know, I'm cutting more sort of islands, amoebic shaped islands, not taking up the lawn, but seeing what happens if I don't mow it anymore. And I'm finding I'm getting these sort of goldenrod, aster, little blue stem, prairie grass, meadow sort of islands, and I'm creating more of those. So that's kind of fun too. It's like almost like instant gardens. And obviously it depends on what you had there. If it was turf, pure turf grass, you may not get what I just said. You may have to add plants,
right.
you know.
Right.
Yeah. Yeah.
Well,
yeah.
Do you think you're going to be a succession manager and let those areas turn into woods?
Up at the very top of the hill inside the fence, which is edges outside my fence would be forest. I have for 2 years now, this will be the third year, stopped mowing to see what came up. And speaking of the oaks, which are the best plant of all, native oaks, oak seedlings, native witch hazel, Hemimelis virginiana seedlings, some of the maple leaf viburnum, which I think is Viburnum acerifolium. So I've been evaluating what the land wants to give me. Do you know what I mean? What wants
yeah.
to, yeah. And, I mean, in some cases, it's probably what a squirrel buried, frankly, but whatever. Do you know what I mean? A nut that, or a seed that someone buried. But, and so now, year three, I'm going to thin a little bit of these sap, these little seedlings, and imagine then what's going to grow at their feet, sort of looking at what's coming up. There's some ferns happening. And so it's interesting. I'm in a more rural area, so this wouldn't necessarily work in a suburban Kentucky bluegrass expanse, you know? You might not get so much diversity. But that's what I'm doing. I'm observing what I have and then thinking of adding other things that would complement or augment these islands that are being created. So that's what I'm doing. I don't know. It's my little experiment, Ken.
It sounds great.
I heard, speaking of natives and non-natives, speaking of collectibles again, I heard that from a little birdie told me that you ordered a snowdrop, a galanthus from England?
A single, small, non-invasive.
No.
Talk about collectors. I bought one of the least expensive English galanthus, which are snowdrops, blooming now, and it came. It was about 12 pounds, and the shipping was more than 12 pounds.
12 pounds in money, not 12 pounds in weight.
Exactly correct. And it's beautiful, and I hate to tell you the name of it, but it's Galanthus trumps.
Trumps?
Mm-hmm.
Oh, my goodness.
I don't know why.
Huh.
But it's beautiful, and I didn't buy it because of the name. I bought it because it was in this list where some of them were $125.
Wow.
For one little bulb.
One bulb.
Yeah.
Yeah, so snowdrops are super collectible. The thing I can never tell, you know, this sounds terrible, I can't tell the difference between them because you kind of have to crawl around on the ground to tell.
Well, I actually have a telescoping dental mirror.
You have a what?
A telescoping dental mirror. Now, I haven't used it, but I think if I if I ever had a Galanthus collection, which is completely unrealistic because it costs too much, I have this little dental mirror that's on a telescoping wand that it clips in your pocket.
So
like
you can look under the flower and see which one it is.
Yeah, so you can see what it's like without getting your stomach wet.
All right. Well, he's still collecting, but he's also making room for more natives. That's Ken Drews. Thank you, Ken. I'm so glad to speak to you as always. We'll compare some more notes soon. Yes, yes?
Yes, yes.
All right.
Underwriting support from Timber Press, your go-to resource for books and gardening and nature. Whether you're a new gardener, a professional at the top of your field, or a reader interested in the wonders of the natural world, their books are there to help you grow. TimberPress.com.
And I hope to talk to all the rest of you again soon. Now, don't miss an episode. You can subscribe free to the podcast version of the show on Stitcher or iTunes or Spotify. And you can find me anytime at awaytogarden.com or on Facebook or Instagram as @awaytogarden. And happy gardening meantime.
A Way to Garden with Margaret Roach is a joint production of awaytogarden.com and the smallest NPR station in the nation, Robin Hood Radio.